This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan. The people of Indonesia, the world's third largest democracy, will be heading to the polls tomorrow, the 14th of February. The three main presidential candidates are Prabowo Subianto from Gerindra, who has current President Jokowi's son Gibran as his running mate. There's also Ganjar Pranowo of PDIP and Anies Baswedan, an independent candidate. So what are the key issues of this election and how will it shape the future of Indonesia and ASEAN? Joining me on the show to help me unpack this is Made Supriyatma, visiting fellow at the Indonesian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. Made Supriyatma, welcome to the show.
Great to have me here.
Before we talk about the upcoming elections, I want to spend a few minutes talking about Jokowi, the current president of Indonesia, and his legacy. Now, he's the country's first president to not have emerged from the political or military elite. Could you give us a summary of his time in power, the big picture, from a political economic perspective?
Start this from his early career as, he used to be the student in forestry department at Gajah Mada University, the university that I also attended. And then he became a businessman. It's a rocky start at first. I think he tried to sell timber and then make it into furniture. But I think after trying hard, apparently he got into the export business, selling furniture to Europe, to the United States. And he got a business partner in early of his career. Later on, his name is very familiar to Indonesian politics, Luhut Binsar Panjaitan. And then in 2008, he ran for a mayor in a small city in Central Java called Surakarta or Solo, which is the center of the Japanese cultures, used to be the capital of the Mataram Kingdom. And then he became the mayor there. And he ran as a PDIP candidate. That was a three-way race at the time. And then he won that. It's a very slim margin, I think at 39 or something like that. But because of three-way race, and then he got elected. He got a national prominence after Indonesian magazine, a liberal-leaning Indonesian magazine, Tempo, put him as the best mayor in Indonesia. That the start of his political career. So the liberal here has a contribution to that. Also the intellectuals. He began to capture people's imaginations when he ran for governor of Jakarta in 2012. At that time, also, he was an underdog. But it's very, very good that, convincing people, fellow businessmen, to support him. And he became the governor. And after 2 years, becoming the Jakarta's governor, and with so many programs that like he did in Solo, but this time he was helped by a maverick called Ahok, or Basuki Cahaya Purnama.
Right.
But Chinese Indonesians are very good at managing everything. So then after 2 years, he becomes a rock star in Indonesian politics, and he ran for president. From that, in 2014, he ran against Prabowo Subianto, and then he became the president. He beat Prabowo Subianto, even though the margin is just like his elections before. At first, it is a very small margin.
Speaking of, rock star and capturing people's imagination, before coming into power, Jokowi was seen within the imagination of the masses as a highly pro-rakyat, center-left, anti-capitalist, work-for-the-workers type of figure. Did he live up to that expectations as the president?
Well, before he became the mayor of Solo, he already rode a baby Benz, a Mercedes. So then after he ran for the mayor, he used Avanza Kijang Avanza, which is a very ordinary the car for the lower middle class Indonesian. So that how, that speaks volume about how he really very consciously crafted his image as the pro rakyat and coming from one of the people. It just like a dream come true, you know, and sending a message that any Indonesians can do like me. But no doubt that he's coming from a lower middle class too. No doubt about that. But then he used it, he capitalized on that in a very smart way. So, yeah, he had a very bright political career. But I think he doesn't interested in history. He doesn't interested in democracy, actually. He is interested in what he called it get things done. But get things done in his mind, I think he want to please people. That's all. But he doesn't want to talk about democracy, freedom. Of course, he will let people to have freedom. He's a very good at crafting image that he's a defender of freedom, but without giving the freedom itself. So
right.
that's one of his skills that no Indonesian politician has that kind of skill.
We live in a global capitalist system, and it is the neoliberal era. It's been for about four decades or so. Mm-hmm. How did Jokowi navigate neoliberalism? Did he challenge it or perpetuate it? You know, on the one hand, he had that image, you know, of a pro-rakyat kind of populist. But at the same time, when you look at major policies, he implemented the highly regressive omnibus law, which curtailed workers' rights across Indonesia. How do you see him navigating neoliberalism?
He embraced neoliberalism, no doubt about that. He's a very pro-market. He's a very pro-business, and business people really like him. He used state's money to build Indonesian infrastructure, even though we don't know yet, because the infrastructure you will have it in 25 years, whether it will stay like that in 25 years or it just crumble after 10 years, we don't know the quality of the work. But I think based on that image, as populist everywhere that I look at the populist and all over the world, all of the populists actually they deceive people. Actually, they are very pro-market. They don't want to change the structures, but they give a little to the people. For example, how Jokowi intensifies giving the social assistance to the poor. So people love him because of that little money. And then he knows how to play with the statistic, for example. And when he took power, the poor in Indonesia, the extreme poor was 29 million. And then it becomes 19 million. So we have 10 million poor people less than when he took power. But the key was that he gives a direct cash transfer to these people, and he sets standards that you are poor if you got 500,000 income a month, and when you give it to these people, to the poor people, 300,000, it changed the calculations, changed the metrics, right? And then they become not poor anymore, statistically, because they got assistance from the state. That's how he cooked the number. It's all over the place. So many of his policy, people like it. People like the toll road, for example. Yeah, of course, the middle class really like the toll road. But if you look at the trucks, who distributed goods in Java, for example, they don't use the toll road because it's so very expensive. They will add costs, so they use the traditional road. So, and then the poor people, now he reformed the train Indonesian trains company. I ride all the time from Jakarta to Jogja and probably 3 or 4 times a month. And that was a very, very comfortable train. But if you look at that carefully, poor people couldn't afford that train. Yeah, poor people doesn't have any transportation. So he served middle class. Another example, he invested hundreds of trillions of rupiah for tourism with the target that in 2024, Indonesia will get 20 million foreign tourists. He created what he called it 10 new Bali in all over Indonesia, Balabuan, Bajo, Raja Ampat, Toba, and everything. A huge money spent in there. But in 2023, what is the result? Not so many Indonesians knows that Malaysia is the top, got the top international visitors by 26 million people, or 6 million, 26 million international visitors from Malaysia, Thailand number 3, and Indonesia even below Singapore. Singapore got 11 million, Indonesia only got 9.3 million. So, but he created an image that we did something big. And I'm afraid his new capital city is also like that. So, but, you know, when he does, he did this, all of this project using state money. And who got the benefit? The rich. Yeah, the very rich Indonesians who got the benefits mostly. Also the Indonesian middle class, because they are very proud of this. We have a motor GP motor circuit in Lombok, and even though it's very expensive to run it, and after the saw the ticket, well, it's good to have the circuit, but we couldn't afford to go there. It's empty now. Yeah.
Let's move on to the upcoming 2024 Indonesian general elections. Who are the three key players and parties that people should keep a close eye on?
There's three candidates, three pairs of candidates. Mm-hmm. One is a former governor of Jakarta named Anies Baswedan, and his vice presidential candidate, Muhaimin Iskandar, which representing the traditional Muslim community to a political party called Partai Kebangsaan, Kebangkitan Bangsa. And the second is Prabowo Subianto, is a former army lieutenant general, fired from his position in 98 because of the kidnapping activists. He had a very, very poor human rights records. But Prabowo had been a presidential candidate for half of his life, I guess. Jokowi beat him twice. So now, because Jokowi has an interest to continue his power, he put his sons as his vice presidential candidate. So then he becomes, he ran for the third time as president. One time as a vice president, two failed, I think three times failed. But now he run again, and he most likely, according to the polling, he will be the next Indonesian president, just like Bongbong Marcos in the Philippines. And the third candidate is the governor of Central Java. He is a member of the biggest political party in Indonesia, the PDIP, the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle, named Ganjar Pranowo.
What are the key issues this elections is centered around?
I think it's interesting that between Prabowo and Ganjar, there's, I think, a competition to become who is the heirs of Jokowi. Right now, what is the main program? Prabowo say that he will continue Jokowi's program, which means that continuing the costly new capital city, continuing to downstreaming Indonesians' natural resources, because especially nickel. We don't know what is the other programs that Prabowo had in mind, except that he promised that he will give a free lunch and free meal to the children. I think in Indonesia, you don't need to have a program, a political programs or any issues that well, people don't care about that. That's why the very popular words in Indonesia in during the election is electability. It's just like likability, you know. If you're an artist, you are really like us. Who is better in dancing or something like that? Who is more funny? Who is more handsome? So that's electability,
right?
And then people call here the communication strategies. How to make you as a candidate is more attractable to the voters. And the voters, I think. I don't know why we all don't like the program, don't like to even though the younger generation start questioning, for example, Prabowo's program, free lunch, 400 trillion rupiah for free lunch. Yeah, first they question, where's the money come from? And Prabowo said, well, of course, it is this budget. And then the second thing, I don't think Prabowo can answer this. So how can you handle it? So this is a huge money. You said that it will create the economy, but who will own that economy? Now people start, especially young people, start questioning that.
On the show with me today is Made Supriyatma, visiting fellow in the Indonesian Studies program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. We will continue this discussion after the break. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan. And on the show with me today is Made Supriyatma, visiting fellow in the Indonesian Studies program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. And we are talking about the upcoming Indonesia general elections taking place tomorrow, the 14th of February. This conversation will also be available on podcast. You just have to look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. We would really, really appreciate it if you subscribe to us on Spotify and drop us a review. So, Prof, how much of Indonesia's politics is centered around class? And I ask this because in Malaysia, as much as I like politics to be centered around class, the reality on the ground is most people just relate to politics through the prism of race and religion. How is it over there in Indonesia?
It's a very, very weak class. And you know that we have a very dark history of that. In 65, almost 1 million were killed because of this. So people are afraid talking about class, and politicians will avoid that, even avoid the term out altogether. So there's no class issues. They will say poor people, well, the poor, but never specify what the poor means. And also the young people, I think that most of Indonesia has a strong demographic bonus this time, 60% of the voters right now are below 30 years of age. They know nothing about the history. They don't care about history. In my generation, in 2014, 2019, we still talk about human rights. But right now, human rights completely disappear from this campaign. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to make an issue about it. And as Prabowo Subianto, it's very easy to deflect that issue. So, because you know, this is not a popular issue in among the young people, and the millennials, maybe because of the social media, they like to see. And Prabowo's team was very good at that. So they created a Goyang Gemoy to hide that Prabowo cannot walk properly because he had stroke before twice. He walks like dancing. So they create the dancing, and that has become very popular. And now people vote based on Prabowo's cat and Prabowo's dance. That's nothing nothing about political program or the idea of the future for this country.
So is it purely personality politics? Just to understand what people are going to the polling booths to vote, what are they voting based on? For example, Malaysia is very, unfortunately, incredibly polarized across racial and religious lines. If we look at just Peninsula Malaysia, there is the East Coast and West Coast divide, which also ties into race and religion politics. In the West Coast, it is more ethnically diverse. It leans towards the current ruling coalition, Pakatan Harapan. And then in the East Coast, which is the Malay heartland, it leans towards PAS and Perikatan Nasional. Could you paint a picture for me in terms of how the Indonesian voter base are split and why? Is religion playing a big role in the upcoming elections, identity politics and culture wars? Or is it a question of, not even that, and it's just purely personality politics?
This time, it's a very different election if we compare 2014 and 2019. Hmm. In 2014, the theme of the campaign is about whether we will defend democracy. So the democracy is under assault. That was in 2014. So you see the people are very, very passionate about politics because they want to defend democracy. All of the activists, I think they are relatively united at that time. And then 2019, because of the Jakarta's governor election in 2017, where Anies Baswedan was painted as a power of radical Islam, something like that. And then Prabowo Subianto embraced he was supporting Anies in 2017. So he aligned himself with the group, the Islamic conservatives. They are not radical, but in my eyes, they are conservative. And then Jokowi's camp, I think, is very successful in depicting him as an Islamic radical. And Prabowo doesn't even know how to pray as a Muslim. He's a Muslim, but he doesn't know. I don't think he prayed, and he never goes to mosque. And so Jokowi's people, every Friday, they will put a hashtag where will Prabowo goes to has the Friday prayer. It's a very, very campaign, very successful. The atmosphere in 2019 was, the 2019 was so very, very divisive because Prabowo was a radical Islam and Jokowi was defenders of pluralism. And so many people didn't know that this is the narrative was set by Jokowi himself and his team, depicting Prabowo. And Prabowo, I think at the time, he countered that issue very lately. Yeah, so that's why. And also reflected in the exit poll. If you use it, if you look at the exit poll in 2019, 97% of the minorities, Christian, Catholic and Protestant, Buddhist, Hindus, and ethnic Chinese, more than 90% voted for Jokowi. It's a very high number. Muslims were divided, almost half and half. Jokowi got 50%, Prabowo got 49%. Jokowi's huge success was creating fears among the minority voters, which is only 12% of Indonesian electorate, and then divide the Muslim into two. He make a deal with Nahdlatul Ulama. So within Islam itself, Islamic force itself, there's a division between the modernists and the traditional conservatives. But a year after that, after he won the election, he embraced Prabowo and make him as his Minister of Defense and revive his political career. Now he supported him as a president. I don't know what to say. When I have to characterize this campaign season, the 2024, I will call it the dispassionate politics, where people just put passion out aside. Politics is in terms of personality and the good looking of the people and the electability.
One thing very interesting about President Jokowi is that on the one hand, he expanded business ties with China. So I want to look at foreign policy for a bit. Now, China is Indonesia's largest trading partner and investor. But at the same time, Jokowi is dancing with Western imperialist powers as well. Not so much just from a trading perspective, because that I think is a common thing in Southeast Asia. We just remain a certain level of neutrality and trade with everyone. But it seems like from a military perspective as well, Jokowi seems to be dancing with Western imperialist powers. Over the past couple of years, Indonesia has increased its military spending, participated in joint military exercises with the US, UK, Australia. What can you tell me about the foreign policy outlook of the next three, about the three presidential candidates? Are they more or less the same? Are they continuing Jokowi's program? Could you shed some light on this?
Between Prabowo and Ganjar, I think they want to continue what Jokowi has done. And Anis, I think, is more interesting because he has his sort of... He want a bigger ties with the Middle East, the rich country in the Middle East. And then I think he understood that Indonesia has to build more stronger brotherhood with the southern globe, Africa and everything, Middle East, Africa, in the country like Turkey. But Anis is not also, he was educated in the U.S. I think he has a very good relationship with the United States. I think he tried to get a balance on this. But I think he will have the main difference between him and the other candidate is that how to deal with China. It's probably Anis will go more with the Western countries and the Middle East countries, and then stay away a little bit from China. And Prabowo, I think he also has a distinct relationship with the Western countries. He was born in Hong Kong, got his early education in England, because at that time he was his father was a refugee under self-exile from Sukarno government. And then, I think Prabowo will have a love and hate relationship with the U.S. and the Western world. And Ganjar, I think, I don't know, I have no idea about Ganjar because, you know, I tried to invite him to give a talk in Singapore at ICS and it failed so many times. I met him personally when I invited him and said that the vote is in Indonesia, not in Singapore. Okay, but you need to talk to the people outside. But it's okay. As far as I know, Ganjar will more of the same with Jokowi. I think he will come the Chinese, but he doesn't want to create a problem with the West. And one thing I think Indonesian politicians don't really pay attention is South Asia. I think it's very important because India in the next decade, I think we will become the very important player, not only in Asia, but globally. Now we are thinking about China, 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 and China. But then, look at the Indian motorcycle, for example, who are now also you available in Indonesia, their cars and everything is much cheaper than China, but better quality, I guess.
There is this unease from my readings among civil society groups that Jokowi, like you said, is trying to retain influence and he's trying to retain influence through his son as a proxy. Now, his son Gibran was only able to run as vice president after a court headed by Jokowi's brother-in-law tweaked the eligibility criteria, and then this decision provoked controversy. Mm. Could you shed some light on this, about the kind of pieces that are being pushed around so that Jokowi can sort of retain his influence within government?
Gibran himself is, I think he's very, very young. He was educated in Indonesia partially, but he did his high school in Singapore. And this is also amazed me because his English is not so good. He did his college in Singapore, and in 2020, I think Indonesian people was very surprised because Jokowi for a long time said that his sons are not interested in politics. He will not build a dynasty. But in 2020, he lobbied for his sons to be the candidate. And at that time, Megawati, agreed to support his son to become a mayor of Solo. And then at that time, I was in the field reporting on that that election. I found out that this guy is just very, very young, but with immense, not only power, money. He created, I was baffled to see a guy who sell pancake has so much money. And then a lot of people, a lot of businessmen want to invest in his business. I don't know, rationally, this is not, you're selling pancakes on the roadside and then you got $5 million to capitalize that company. And but people don't mind at that time. It's okay. And then now we saw something bigger than that started from becoming mayor, just like his father as a governor. He didn't finish the term. He just 2 years in office, and now he ran for a very, very high office of vice president. Actually, by putting Gibran is a liability for Prabowo.
Right.
That's let's put it in that way. But because of Jokowi, Gibran becomes a boon for Prabowo right now. This is like 97. The government's party got more than 70%, and they are all over the place. And a year after that, the government's collapsed.
Madhya, we are living in very interesting times when we look at global political economy. You know, the US empire is on a decline. We are slowly moving towards a multipolar world from a unipolar world. And I think with all of that in mind, it is especially important for ASEAN to be a united, progressive, small power in the region. When we look at the three presidential candidates in Indonesia, what are their approach to bolstering ASEAN? Do they have any ideas when it comes to regional collaboration? Or are these candidates uninspiring in that sense that, you know, ASEAN is just going to continue being what ASEAN is? Really all talk, not much action.
I don't think anybody in ASEAN interested in solving their own problem. That's a problem. Indonesia used to lead.
Right.
That's because of the personality of the Minister of Foreign Affairs. We are very lucky to have Mokhtar Kusumatmaja, and especially we have Ali Alatas, even though Ali Alatas has a big problem. Somebody has to lead. Indonesia, especially Indonesia, has to take initiative. I don't think in the three candidates they care about these issues. Yeah, why ASEAN become the so ritualized? Let's say it like that. So ritualized, it's because nobody want to take a leadership. And Indonesia is not interested in taking leadership. You look at what happened in the 80s. In Cambodia, for example, Indonesia just jumped in, defying the statute of ASEAN, non-interference. Indonesia was very, very involved at that time and sending a peacekeeping mission. I think Indonesia should do the same in Myanmar, but I think it's easier to do because the West are not interested in that. And China also not really. I think China, you can still talk about Myanmar. So why would we not create something for Myanmar? No, I think Indonesian president right now, they don't want to meddle in this kind of issues. I think it's a matter of our leader, if I can say it honestly, is a little bit lazy in dealing with this kind of issues. I think we take pride when we can open one Indonesian restaurant in Europe, for example, then solving the problem for 40 million, probably 30 million people in Myanmar. I think that's the key. There's nobody, no countries want to lead. And then in order to lead, you need the power to do that. And Indonesia has the biggest power in ASEAN. So logically, Indonesia has to lead. It's just like Sukarno. If Sukarno is still alive, I think he will take a lead in order to solve this kind of problem. If Indonesia lead, I think other countries will follow.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the presidential candidates, which is, of course, key to these elections. But are there any new and interesting parties that are inspiring Indonesian working class, that are inspiring progressives in Indonesia? Are there any new parties that, you know, it could be a small party that people should keep an eye on? You know, I'm just reading stuff on Partai Buruh. Are there these sorts of parties that people should keep an eye on?
Yeah, some in the left say that, well, Partai Buruh is promising. Well, I don't think so, because of the, you know, the leaderships right now and the people who are involved in that political party, they are dealing with the business and the capitalists a lot. Other than that, if you say that, I'm cynically will say that the party that attracted attention the most in Indonesia is K-pop.
Well, that's the same thing all parts of the world today, isn't it?
Yeah, before we tried in 2019, some Indonesian businesses tried to create, because of the polarizations brought by Jakarta governor election. So they put the money, huge money, to create the Partai Solidaritas Indonesia, Indonesian Solidarity Party. But then they failed to get the threshold to go to the parliament. And that political party now being taken over by Jokowi's younger sons, Kaisar Pangarep. So that's it's a very irony. And I think in 2019, a lot of young people involved in this political party, especially the middle class, of ethnic Chinese and minorities, they're involved in that party. So they got 2.8 million votes. That's huge.
That is huge.
Yeah, but that's because of the big money from Indonesian tycoon, and now also big money from Indonesian tycoon plus back from President Jokowi. Let's see whether they will make the threshold. Yeah.
So, before we wrap this conversation up, you know, we're very, very close to elections already. Would you have some final thoughts or even predictions? Who do you think is going to become the next president of Indonesia?
As sadly, it's just my colleague at ICS, Burhanuddin Mutadi, through his company, Indikator Politik, just released a survey, and Prabowo got 52% electability again. That's the words, the electability. There's some factors in that. But I think it's more likely it will go to only one round and Prabowo will be the president. But there's a big but in here. There's a very strong discontent right now, especially among intellectuals, professors, academics, activists, and students, and they voice their disappointment and their frustration on the process of the this campaign and the process of the being a candidate, especially towards Jokowi's and Gibran. So they already talk about impeachment, and I don't think the situation is going to be better if the election over in one round. So let's see. Because now students are rallying in the streets, and then professors issuing statements, intellectuals start voicing their dissent. So we don't know where this is heading to, but I think will we see like 97, that a year after that, the government collapse? I hope I don't want to see that kind of thing happens again. But I don't want to see that somebody, this is my political preference, somebody who kill Indonesian citizens to become the president of Indonesia too. So somebody that has no accountability whatsoever for what he did in the past in terms of human rights. And also I have a very bleak picture for the future of this country. If we want to become to reach progress, we should take accountability of our leaders seriously.
Made, on that note, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
That was Made Supriyatma, visiting fellow in the Indonesia Studies program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. This conversation is also available on podcasts. We are available on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. You just have to look up Beyond the Ballot Box. If you could subscribe to us, drop us a review. I would really, really appreciate it. I'm Dashrin Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.